Welcome back to another episode of Better Than I Found It, the podcast all things college golf. You're listening to Mike McGraw, the men's golf coach at Baylor University. Today's guest on Better Than I Found It is former Oral Roberts University golfer Jim Kane. Jim, who was a four-time All-American at Oral Roberts, also played briefly on the PGA Tour and enjoyed a long career as a PGA head club professional. He reminisces about his days in college golf on one of the best teams in the country and also gives clues as to what made his college coach a great one. Enjoy the listening. Okay, Better Than I Found It faithful, join me in welcoming former Oral Roberts All-American Jim Kane to the podcast today. Jim, I really appreciate you taking the time out to visit with me.
Well, Mike, thank you for having me. It's going to be a great opportunity to chat with you.
Well, and a great opportunity to catch up. Our paths haven't crossed in a long time. We knew each other way back when, and we actually played in college. You were there. Your last 3 years were my first 3 years of college golf. So, and we crossed paths occasionally. Central Oklahoma played in the All College Classic, which you played in at Lincoln Park. But anyway, we haven't crossed each other's paths in a long time. Kind of catch me up. Where are you right now? What are you doing?
Well, I'm happily retired after being a club pro for 20 plus years. I'm very fortunate to live right here at Oak Tree National on number 3. And very fortunate to be a member at Oak Tree National. So I get to see some of my college friends, guys, you know, Willie Wood and Scott Verplank and Bob Tway, when he still lived here, he lived right across the street from me. So it's a wonderful, wonderful facility, and I don't compete much anymore. Unfortunately, my wife had breast cancer a few years ago. So I was kind of the nurse ratchet, if you will, while she was going through radiation and chemo. And thank God she's cancer free now. So I don't really compete much anymore. And it's great. I get out and practice and play with some of my old friends. Of course, you know, Mark Felder and Mark and Mark just retired. And Mark and I, just a quick little note, Mark retired in April. And last year when he told me he was going to retire, we both made a pact that what we were going to do is we were going to get some of the older guard, the Art Proctors of the world, who were always so good to us, and get them out and take them to some places and play golf. So we did that this summer and took Art and Larry Fryer and some other guys. And we went up to Enid and played one day and just had a ball with them. So life is good.
You know, I've only played one round of golf this year, and it was with Art Proctor and Mark Felder.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
At Kicking Bird when they had the grand reopening. And, gosh, it was fun playing with those guys.
Art is amazing.
I was shocked at how far Art still hits the ball.
Unbelievable at 84 years old. Or 84 and a half. Got to say 84 and a half.
Okay.
So, anyway.
Well, he's pretty amazing to still be hitting it like he does. And Felder. We had a great day that day. That was fun. Brought back a lot of memories. So good. I'm glad you're still playing, even though you're not competing.
Nope.
Good that you're still playing. So, you know, I had your college coach, Bill Brogdon, your Oral Roberts coach, on my podcast a couple months ago. Great catching up with Bill.
Yeah.
He told some great stories. And that guy was way too humble. He didn't talk nearly enough about how great a basketball player he was and all the things he accomplished. He was way too humble, but it was great having him on. I'm going to ask this question right off the bat. Just what qualities did Bill have that made him a really good coach? I always am interested to know. He didn't brag on himself. So you can tell me, why was Bill a good coach?
Well, I would just echo what you just said. Bill is so humble. That was one of his best qualities. And still is to this day. But, you know, Bill came from a basketball background, as I did. And what he learned from his dad about coaching and about taking care of players and listening to players and supporting players, et cetera, Bill had all those qualities. He you know, he was smart enough. I mean, now it's been 40 years since we played, but I think he was smart enough at the time when we were all assembled, when myself and Joey Rassett and Brian Norton and Bill Glass, and when we were all assembled, I think Bill realized that he had some really hardworking, focused kids. And it was almost like he took a half a step back and just let us do our deal. And I think that that's what he, I think that was probably his best quality. Now, there were times when we would each individually have some issues, as I'm sure you go through with your players. And Bill was just a, you know, he was just such a great support group for us. And, you know, gosh, I just treasure him to this day. It's just amazing.
Well, you bring up a good point. We coaches sometimes try to do too much. We feel like we've got to put our thumbprint on it or our stamp of approval on what's happening. And sometimes you just got to let the thoroughbreds run, and they're going to show you how well they can run. I actually learned that from Mike Holder, because he learned it the hard way too at Oklahoma State. He was trying to do too much for too long, and he realized, I've got these great players. I just need to let them go.
And everyone has a different personality. You know, I will tell you that Joey Rassett had a different personality than me, and Bill was able to navigate around that. You know, Joey was not a guy that wanted to be patted on the back all the time. He just wanted to be left alone, and he was going to do his own deal, and I'm going to be the leader, and don't worry about me. And that's kind of, you know, but then on the other hand, I was more of a guy that needed to be a, you know, pat on the back and way to go, Kaner, and all that kind of stuff. And Bill was able to navigate around that. So,
well, he talked about his dad's influence on his coaching a little bit. Yeah. He did mention sort of that. His dad taught him that. So, but you just mentioned four names, yourself included, but Brian Norton, Joey Rassett, Bill Glasson, all Americans.
Yes.
All showed up sort of at the same time, although you weren't exactly the same years, but you were all there at the same time at some point. My goodness, he did what I said. Not very many coaches were able to compete against Mike Holder's teams in those days. He had the best team in the country every year, basically. But you guys did a great job of that. How in the world did Bill get all four of you in Tulsa, Oklahoma?
Boy, is that a good question. I think fate had a lot to do with it. I know that the podcast, the conversation you had with Coach, he explained about the fact that Jesse Haddock had left Wake Forest, which was, you know, unbelievable that he left Wake and came to ORU. And unfortunately for Coach Haddock, it just wasn't a good mix for him at ORU. And but when Coach Haddock came to ORU, he brought a player by the name of Mark Tinder, who received the Arnold Palmer Scholarship at Wake. And Coach Haddock was almost like a father, well, was a father figure to Mark. So when Coach Haddock made the announcement that he was going to leave Wake, Mark said, I want to go with you. So Mark came to Tulsa, and Mark was from California. He was from Monterey. So anyway, that's kind of where it all started. Was Mark had to redshirt a year. And when he redshirted, you know, Coach Haddock had left. Bill came in, and I think for a while there, Mark Tinder was actually acting as the coach, and he was doing recruiting, and he was, you know, he was helping Brogdon when he came in and had the list of guys from California to talk to. And so it started with Mark, and then it kind of was kind of a domino effect. And all of a sudden they get Joey Rassett, and then Joey got me. And then, as fate would have it, Brian Norton was from Kansas, and he didn't want to stay in Kansas. He actually wanted to come to Oklahoma because he liked the golf in Oklahoma, the great players from Oklahoma. And he actually took a recruiting trip to Tulsa, but he didn't really want to go to Tulsa for numerous reasons. And I think you may not know this, but Brian used to go to the Oklahoma State golf camp.
Mike
and he
Holder
went to the
that.
Oklahoma State golf camp that summer of our senior year. And God rest his soul, Laban Harris, who was friends with Brogdon, told Coach Brogdon, you need to look at this kid from Salina, Kansas, named Brian Norton. That's where the introduction was. Brian immediately liked Coach Brogdon, just having a conversation with him. And he said, I'm coming. And so he comes. And then a year later, we get Bill Glasson.
Wow.
It's just, you know, is that kind of the way the recruiting works now, Coach?
No, it doesn't work. It doesn't work exactly that way. I will tell you, though, that things happen that you don't expect all the time. So Bill Brogdon got to Oral Roberts and had no idea Mark Tender was going to help him get some California kids.
No idea.
Brian Norton coming to Mike Holder's golf camp and Laverne Harris, who was still working the camp, happened to say, hey, you know, Mike's not interested in this kid. Why don't you take a look? And all of a sudden, you guys have this top five team in the country out of nowhere.
Yeah.
And wow, what a group of guys you had. I mean, all of them did something in the game of golf big, you know, at some point. But you guys, you had 4 years. I want to talk about one specific tournament in a minute, and that's probably your last tournament as a collegiate player, actually, the NCAA in 81.
Mine, Joey, and Brian's. Yeah.
Yeah. Before we get to that, though, you know, I've always cherished and treasured van rides, opportunities for guys to be with each other for long stretches of time, because you get to know their personalities more so maybe than in qualifying, where they're nervous and they're, you know, or practice where you're getting on to them, or you're, you know, you're challenging them. But the van rides always seem kind of fun. Do you have any memories of things that happened at tournaments or anything from that group that you enjoyed?
Yeah, I would say, gosh, I hate to pick on Brian Norton, but we played in a tournament out in California in Fresno. I think we went out for spring break. There were a couple tournaments there. And of course, Joey grew up not too far from Fresno. And of course, Bill was from, Rick Glasson was from Fresno. So we went out there and we played Belmont Country Club, which was a real tight little golf course in Fresno. I mean, really tight. Not very long. And Norton had a little trouble. I can't remember what hole it was, but he kept hitting it out of bounds. And and Brogdon was out there watching him, and he's just, you know, he's, Brogdon's head's down and he got his hands over his face and he can't friggin' believe it because Norton keeps hitting it out of bounds. So we get done and we're, you know, in a group on the 18th green and, you know, how did you play? How'd you play? And everybody's saying, the Norton, we go, hey, Brian, you know, how'd you play? So this hitting the ball out of bounds came up. And of course, Joey Rassett, with his cold sense of humor, says, well, why didn't you just hit like an 8-iron off the tee after you hit two balls out of bounds? And Norton goes, because I couldn't hit that in the play either.
We've all been there, right?
Oh, yeah. So it was something else. I mean, I'm sure there's a lot more. You know, we had such great memories. I still remember, as you and I talked earlier about the all college, was it the all college tournament at Lincoln?
What a great tournament that was.
That was an awesome tournament. So, and I think that was our first tournament every year in the fall. And so our senior year, we go play the all college. We played there every year. So we go there and everybody that was important to us to play against was there. I mean, Oklahoma State was playing. So we were playing. So we go and we're playing and it's the last round. I'm in the second to last group. Joey's in the Rassett's in the last group. I think he's playing with Bob Tway and I don't know who else. And you remember, you know, this 18th hole was that little short par four. Mm-hmm. And so our fifth guy plays out, Glasson putts out, Norton putts out. I'm on the 18th fairway. I wedge it up on the green and I think the 17th hole was a par five. And so anyway, so Rassett's walking up to the 18th tee and we're all down there because we know it's close. So we ask Coach, because Coach is standing on the 18th tee. We go, Coach, how did we stand? And he goes, what'd you make, Kaner? And I said, I think I made par. I don't remember. And Coach goes, well, we're tied. Mm-hmm. We're tied with Oklahoma State. And we go, well, how's Joey doing? And he goes, he's tied. I don't know if he was tied with Bob or whoever it was. So Rassett comes walking up to the 18th tee, and the first thing he says is, how do we stand? And Brogdon goes, we're tied. And Joey looked right at him, and he said, I got this covered. And he teed up a driver, and he drove it about 20 yards in front of the green. He chipped it up about 2 feet, tapped it in for birdie, He won the individual by a shot, and we won the team by a shot. And that was the start of our senior year. I will never forget that.
Sure, that was a the beginning of a self-belief that you guys might have had that maybe we can beat these guys and maybe it can happen this year.
It was. But then we went on and won the next three tournaments. And Joey won all three of them, all four of them. Yeah. How about that?
I don't think that's amazing. I don't think very many kids from this generation have a clue how good Joey Rassett was.
He was just phenomenal.
He was amazing. Yeah, good story. I actually played in that tournament. Central Oklahoma, we were there. We actually led after 18 holes. We shot 275, and it was like this big shock. I mean, huge shock. We didn't hang on. I think we ended up finishing fourth that week, but yeah, that was a big week for our team. Big week for our team. I remember that. So when people think of Oral Roberts University in the 1960s and 70s, you can't help but think of Oral Roberts, the man. He was still alive, still preaching, still evangelizing. I mean, he was still a very big part of the faith-based community. I know you played golf with him. Describe how playing golf with Oral Roberts was.
Well, first of all, he was a very good player. He was, if I recall correctly, he was a single-digit handicapper. He was maybe like 7 or 8 or 9 at Southern Hills. And his son Richard was a very good player. But, you know, Oral was, he was a very humble guy. He really enjoyed us as a team. You know, he enjoyed all the athletes at ORU, but when it came to golf, you know, he had a passion for golf, and he could spend time with us on the golf course. Unlike, you know, you're not going to go on the basketball court and play a one-on-one with, or two-on-two with some of the guys on the basketball team. But yeah, we kind of had a unique relationship with him. I would say that Joey had probably more of a closer relationship with him. As the years went on, we played more and more with him without coach. I mean, it was not uncommon for us to get a message in the athletic dorm from Brogdon saying, "Hey, you and Joey need to go meet Oral at 2 o'clock at Southern Hills." And we'd go out and play golf with him at Southern Hills. So I think it was a very, very fond memories. He was great to us. He really was.
Well, and he also, you said something to me earlier that basically Bill Brogdon in the early years did not have to do any fundraising.
No.
Oral Roberts just said, "This program is going to, we're going to build a program here. Don't worry about the money."
Correct. That's exactly right.
Yeah, that's every coach's dream.
Exactly.
I mean,
yeah.
You recruit players, but you have to recruit money too. It's a real deal nowadays.
Yeah.
So he did. Obviously the money didn't get all of you players there, but once you players were there, it was nice for Coach Brogdon to have great players and unlimited resources. Pretty amazing. Yes. You know, with four great players like that, it's always occurred to me as a coach, even though we try to put our thumbprint on everything, player-led coaching is actually better than coach-led coaching. In other words, you four players probably did a great job of coaching each other, pushing each other, challenging each other. Is that the case for you guys?
Oh, that without a doubt, that was the case. And to kind of go back to Mark Tinder, I don't recall Mark having the foresight of, you know, I'm going to really, you know, Jesse Haddock's gone, and I'm really going to kind of help this program get started, and we're going to win a national championship. I don't think that didn't come from Mark Tinder. That came from Joe Rassett as soon as he stepped foot in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And that's what he told Coach Brogdon. He said, "Coach, we're going to win a national championship here, and I'm going to do whatever I can to do that. And we're going to get some players who are going to who are going to be on the same page as we are." And I had no problem with it. I mean, it was just like, well, what else are you going to shoot for? You know, I'm not going to go to school here or go to school anywhere and have them pay for my education, and I'm able to travel around the country and play in these golf tournaments and twiddle my thumbs and not give them my best. So it really, you're exactly right. I think Coach Brogdon would admit that you know, Joey was really this, he spearheaded the whole thing. And I think Brogdon kind of just hung on his coattails. You know what I mean? So, but yeah, we all, you know, we all pushed one another, and we knew what we had to do individually to get better. And I'm sure you would agree, Mike, that you have to compete. You have to play in golf tournaments. And, you know, unfortunately for Bill Glasson, he came from humble beginnings, and he didn't have the money or the finances to go play in the summer and go play the Western Am and the Sunny Ana and the Porter Cup and, you know, the California Amateur and all that kind of stuff like the rest of us did. But he did enough, you know, he worked at it. And anyway, so that's what it was. I mean, we played a full schedule in the summer. It was unbelievable. And very fortunate that our families were supportive of it. And so we were focused. I mean, it was, you know, and then I know you brought it up, but, you know, and then to have it all end in 1981 and we were just right there and lose by two shots. I mean, it was heart wrenching. It really was.
Well, talk about that week. It was, the NCAA championship, it's just the culmination of a great year, probably the best year in Oral Roberts University history for sure.
Oh, no doubt. Yeah.
And you have a chance to do something that's history making or historical.
Sure.
Talk about that week. It was at Stanford, I believe.
It was at Stanford.
Yeah.
You know, I grew up about 20 miles from Stanford. I had played a lot of golf at Stanford Golf Course, had a lot of friends that anyway. So I played a lot of golf there. Joey played a significant amount of golf there too. So we were all very excited, and we Stanford had a tournament there in the fall, and so which we won, and so you know we felt really good. I mean, Brian liked the golf course, Glasson liked the golf. I mean, we all liked the golf course, and our families were going to be there. You know, I think that was one of the drawbacks that we didn't have that, let's say, Oklahoma State did have. You know, Oklahoma State had some history. I mean, gosh, you guys had, you know, Doug Toole and Danny Edwards, and I'm sure I'm missing guys that, you know, Mark Hayes, you know, before Coach Holder took over, you guys had some history. We had none, zero. Mm-hmm. And so anyway, it was great at the NCAAs. I mean, our families were there, so we had some support outside the ropes, and you know, we got off to a great start. Of course, Rassett shoots 67 the first round, and we're like, okay, here we go, you know, because Joey was amazing. I mean, he was so reliable that he put less pressure on the rest of us, you know, because if he goes out and shoot, you know, I remember Brogdon telling me after my freshman year, he sat me down in his office and he just said, Kaner, he says, here's what I expect of you. This is what I expect of you. And he expected me to be consistent, to work hard. He didn't give me a score. He just said, that's it. Now, Joey's a different deal. What I expect of Joe Rassett is I expect Joe Rassett to individually compete for the championships that we play in. He's going to win golf tournaments. I'm not really expecting that of you. I think you can. And so, you know, anyway, so we went to Stanford, and we felt really good, especially after the first round. After three rounds, we were right there. And then we played the last round with BYU, and I think we played with Houston. Mm-hmm. I think we played with Houston. And I was in the second to last group. Joey was in the last group. And I played with Keith Clearwater, great guy, still a good friend today. And I think Joey played with Zick Sokol. And so I remember that, I don't know if you been to Stanford, Coach?
I have.
Okay, yes. So you know the 17th hole's the par 5, or the 16th hole's the par 5, 17's a really good par 3, and 18's a friggin' monster. Mm-hmm. So we were plugging along, and then I get up to the 17th tee, and there's like two groups on the tee. Like, what in the heck is going on here? So they had a big backup. And anyway, as it turns out, we had a couple guys that that didn't play 17 and 18 very well, and we ended up losing by two. And it was It was just heart-wrenching. I mean, it was so, you know, just, I mean, here it is 42 years later, and I'm still, it still hurts, you know?
You know, Ben Hogan said at Cherry Hills in 1960, when he dumped that wedge in the water, well, he didn't dump it, he spun it back into the water.
Spun it back, yeah.
When he had a chance to win, he said, I think about that every day. He says, like, it doesn't, 30 minutes don't go by, and I thought about it. So that's the great part about competition, is it means that much to you. It really does. And so you can talk about it here 42 years later. It still means something to you. But you mentioned Joey Rassett being like always the leader, always pushing the envelope. We coaches in college golf like to refer to guys like him as an eraser. He erases bogeys. He erases bad things that happen because he just shoots low all the time.
That's well said, yeah.
Yeah, so every team needs an eraser. If you can get one, get it quickly.
Yes.
Yeah. But, no, that's great. BYU won that year. You guys did not, but certainly a great memory for you. And historical team, you know, having been from Oklahoma, and I watched that take place basically as a junior in college, it was – I mean, to beat Oklahoma State, especially Bob Tway was the college player of the year that year.
Yes,
and, you know,
their
team finished fourth, and he was a great player on a great team that just could not beat you guys that year at Nationals. So,
and they were all in the bleachers on the last hole watching us finish.
Yeah.
I'll never forget that. All of them were. And Coach Holder.
You know, and that's what I want to say too here. You mentioned something to me in a text message before we got on this phone call, but that Mike actually complimented you. Talk about that, because most people don't realize that part of Mike. When he saw excellence and when he saw a great accomplishment, he would tell somebody that.
Yeah, it was, I can't recall if it was right after the tournament, meaning, you know, that Joey was in the last group, whether he signed the card or whatever. I don't think it was. I think it was after the ceremony, you know, after they gave BYU their trophy and we got our runner up and they did the individuals and all that kind of stuff. I think it was after that. And we already had our gathering. Brogdon gathered us all together. And it was sometime after that. People were still hanging around. And I just remember Coach Holder coming over. I don't know if – I think it was me and Joey and Brian and Bill. And he just he kind of blew us away, and he complimented us on our competitiveness and our work ethic, and he just said, you know, you guys were really, really tough to deal with. I mean, I'm paraphrasing, and he just, you know, he said something to the effect, you know, keep your head high, and you know, good luck in the future, and blah blah blah, and you guys were great. And it was like that. And I've never forgotten that 42 years later. I will never forget that, to be honest with you. So,
yeah, I think that's part of his personality people don't understand. He truly appreciated hard work and excellence and something that was great. And when a guy competed hard, he appreciated it regardless of what team you're on. So,
exactly.
Okay. So anyway, you end up turning professional after the NCAA championship, and you ended up playing in the PGA Tour one full year I know of, 1984.
But I must backtrack.
Go ahead.
I went back to ORU. I finished 81 was my senior year, and then my dad basically said, now you know you're going to graduate, right? And I'm like, really? And he goes, you're going back to school and you're getting your degree. I had a deal with Coach Brogdon before you went to school that you were going to graduate. And I said, okay. So I went back in 82, graduated, and then I turned pro. You know, back then they didn't have a Corn Ferry. You had to go play mini tours. So I did that. I went to Q school. I didn't get my card. And then I went to Q school in 83, in the fall of 83. And I think back then they had two qualifiers to get to the finals. And the finals were at TPC Sawgrass. And that was the year Willie Wood won. And I finished 12th. I played really good. I will tell you a quick story about that. It's before the last round. I'm on the range hitting balls. And I'm in really good shape. I mean, I'm really good shape. I actually have two stories. So I'm on the range hitting balls. And Raphael Alarcon's playing. You know, we became really good friends still to this day. And so Raphael came up to me and, you know, in his little Spanish drawl there thing. And He says, hey, you know, Kaner, go out there and, you know, play good, have a great day, you know, blah, blah, blah. I'm going, okay, great. Well, Bob Tway was playing a few holes behind me, and that was the year that Bob shot, I think, 80 or something like that. And I was just crushed. I couldn't believe it. But anyway, so yeah, so I finished 12th and got full exempt for 84. And that was the second year the tour went all exempt. So they had all kinds of tweaks that they needed to do to the all exempt players that started in 83. And anyway, so I think I only got in about half the events because they did the reshuffle thing. But I was no way ready to play the PGA Tour. Let me tell you, I was no way ready to play the PGA Tour. I think a part of me thought I was, you know, I was a four-time All-American. I won a bunch of great amateur events. I had a really good career, and then whammo, I'm on the PGA Tour. And I'm like, wait a second, I am not ready for this. And of course, I think that my performance showed that, but it was a great experience. I loved it. There was a lot more to it than I thought. And unfortunately, well, I never got back out on tour.
Well, I want to talk about one tournament specifically that happened 8 years after that, when you played in the U.S. Open at Pebble Beach. Before we talk about that, piggybacking off what you just said, I'm not ready. No. Tell me, what are the qualities that got a guy that was 5'8", 100 nothing? What are the good qualities you had that got you there to the tour? But what are the qualities you lacked that would have kept you out there longer?
Well, of course, as you know, back then you didn't have to hit it 320. And I hit, you know, for my size, I hit it plenty far. I had a great short game. I was a really good wedge player. I was great around the greens, which had a lot to do with where I was brought, where I grew up playing golf. But I had all the shots, and I was pretty mentally tough, but I didn't really have real inner confidence of, you know, I'm really a good player, and I just kind of need to worry about Jim Kane, and the ball doesn't really know who I am. I just need to go forward. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And I kind of wish I would have had it over again, but you know, it is what it is. I remember my first tournament was at San Diego. No, so was it San Diego? Yeah, I think it might've been San Diego. Well, I got an exemption into the Crosby because I was good friends with Nathaniel Crosby and Joey Rassett. I got an exemption. But anyway, so my first tournament was at San Diego, and I go out there to play a practice round, and I ended up getting a hold of some friends. It was John Cook, Mark O'Meara, and somebody else, because now these guys had already been out for a couple of years, right? But they were my buddies, and we used to travel in the summer. I'm like, oh, okay, great. So we go out there, and we're at a practice round at Torrey Pines, and they had a tent on the first tee, I think it was. And it was kind of just, you just show up and go tee off. So they're standing out in front of this tent, and they're talking to somebody in the tent. And I come walking down with my caddy, and I'm thinking, oh, you know, whatever, it's one of our old college buddies or something we're going to play golf with. And I walk in the tent, and John Cook waves me over, and he goes, hey, Kaner, come over here. He goes, I want you to meet somebody. I turn around, I look in the tent, it's Tom Watson. I'm like, oh my gosh, what, it really? And I'm just shaking like a leaf, you know, and he couldn't have been nicer. And he ended up playing a few holes with us, but that was kind of my, you know, whereas nowadays, as I'm sure you will attest to, these college players in the last decade or so, I mean, you know, they get so much experience of playing with tour players and playing in tour events. You know, there were only maybe a handful of guys in my era that had that opportunity. You know, John Cook from winning the amateur, Mark O'Meara from winning the amateur, Joey Rassett got some exemptions when he was an amateur, but they're a lot more seasoned at it than I was.
Wow. You know, Tom Watson was the number one player in the world, even though they weren't rankings at the time. You couldn't pick anybody else to be number one in the world other than Tom Watson.
Yes. Yes.
Who were some of the other notable players you actually got paired with that full year you were on tour?
I got paired a couple of times with Lanny Watkins, and he could not have been nicer. He was awesome, actually. I got to play with Ben Crenshaw, and he won the Masters that year. I played with him at, the Western Open in Chicago, where they had it at Butler National. And I played with him. It was either the third round or the fourth round. I can't remember. Calvin Pete, I got to play with a few times. That guy was just simply amazing. Nice, nice man.
This generation has
no
clue.
No clue.
By the
no,
way,
no
hit clue. It nowhere. Hit it nowhere is the most accurate player in history. He made the cut in every single Masters he played. In eight Masters, he never missed the cut. That's a long golf course. Calvin Pete, and by the way, only Tom Watson won more tournaments in the 1980s than Calvin Pete. The guy was an absolute magician. It was unbelievable.
He was. I played with him and Lanny Watkins the third round at New Orleans. And watching those two guys go at it was unbelievable. I mean, that's kind of where I was. I was like, oh, my God, these guys are this is not my league. I was like, geez, can I just carry your guy's bag?
Well, but, that reminds me, one year I was playing in the U.S. Open sectionals. And I'd made it through the local, and I honestly don't remember what year it was, but I'm having breakfast with Jim Woodward. We're going to go out and play that day. And he says, so tell me, McGraw, just what are you going to do if you actually do qualify for the U.S. Open? And I looked at him and I said, you know, Jim, I have no idea, Woody. I got no idea. And I didn't make it.
That sounds like Woody.
He did. And he finished 17th or 18th in the U.S. Open. But
He did at the Olympic Club in San Francisco.
It was.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yep.
So 1992 U.S. Open at Pebble Beach. Here's my memories watching it on television. Okay. First of all, Pebble Beach played really hard that year. I mean.
Oh, it was easy.
brutal. Lots of wind. Gil Morgan became the first player in history to get to 10 under par in a U.S. Open.
Yep.
He didn't finish there, but he got there.
Yes.
Andy Dillard birdied the first six holes of that U.S. Open. Nobody's ever done that before or since. Tom Kite finally won a major, which he'd been close a lot of times, and he finally won a major. And then, obviously, the weather conditions and the tough rough that you had to fight and the firm greens. So that's my memory watching it on television. You finished 23rd. Other than that's probably your best finish in a major. What do you remember about that week?
Well, I remember prior to that, I remember the two qualifiers I had to go through. One was the local qualifier was at Peninsula Country Club in San Mateo, where I grew up. So, geez, I was all excited about that. And I was medalist there for that qualifier. And then the sectional qualifier was at another golf course that I played a lot, Lake Merced, which is a fantastic golf course. And so, and at Lake Merced, the sectional, you know, I played pretty good in the morning, and I shot four over. I shot 76, and at that time, an old friend of mine, an old member from Peninsula Country Club named Bob Roos, was out walking and watching, and he came up to me after I signed my card, getting ready to go for my second 18, and he put his hand on my shoulder and he said, "Hey, Jimmy," he says, "you're still in this." He goes, "Just go out and play a good round this afternoon." He said, "No," he said, "go out and shoot under par this afternoon, and you're going to make it." And I went, "Really?" Because I'm thinking 76, you know, I'm out. And so I went out, and I believe I shot two under in the afternoon, and I made it. And that's when I was working at the Olympic Club. I was the assistant head pro at the Olympic Club. And, you know, I grown up in San Mateo, I played Pebble Beach a bunch because we used to have the state am there every year. And I used to go down there and play all the time. So I felt comfortable, you know, on the golf course, but it was a totally different golf course when I took a practice round. It's like, wait a minute. I played this course when the greens are a little firm, but not like this. So anyway, but I did have some great advice. Speaking of Gil Morgan, I ran into Gil after one of the practice rounds, and you know, Gil, he's such a terrific guy.
One of the greatest guys in the history of the game.
Unbelievable. He's one of the guys that I got to play practice rounds with when I was on tour a lot. He and Doug Toole and Mark Hayes were great to me. Anyway, so I was kind of being half facetious, and I said, "Hey, Gil," I go, "so what's your strategy about playing this golf course?" And he was dead serious. And he said, let me give you a piece of advice. Hit it in the bunkers, not in the rough. And I went, really? And he goes, hit it in the bunkers, not in the rough. He goes, you can't hit it out of the rough. And he's, and even around the greens, if you're going to miss the green, miss it in a greenside bunker. Greatest advice I ever got.
Great
but it
advice.
Was the golf course was, you know, again, the golf course always seemed to suit my game. I drove it straight. I hit it straight. I putted good. And, you know, I made the cut, and then I played the third round with Ian Woosnam, and he was great. He started out, what did he do? He went birdie, birdie. No, he went birdie, eagle, birdie, par, birdie or something the first few holes. And then anyway, so then, and then the last round was very memorable. I played with Willie Wood. We had a great time. The
Speaking
weather
of another
was
great guy.
Another great guy. We're just cruising around having a great time. And then we got to number 15. Was it 15? No, 14, the par five. We hit our drives, and Willie looked up in the sky, and we finally, for the first time all week, we saw a patch of sunlight. Like the fog was kind of like starting to finally burn off the overcast. And of course, you know, I grew up around there. So Willie's like, you know, what's going on right here, Kaner? And I go, well, I guess the fog's going to burn off, and it's probably going to get a little bit windy. And he went, really? And oh my gosh, in about, in about 10, before we got to the 15th tee, it was friggin' howling. So we play 15, we tee off on 16, we hit our second shots down on the 16th green, and Gil Morgan and those guys are on three green. And I mean, it's a nightmare. I absolutely smoked a three wood on 17. Greatest shot I think I ever hit. I smoked a three wood on 17 and knocked it on the green. It was just unbelievable.
So I've got, and you can go on YouTube and find the video of Gil Morgan hitting a punch shot into the wind.
Yes.
I don't know if you've ever seen that or not, but it's on the seventh or eighth, or not the seventh, eighth or ninth hole, eight, nine, ten, right in there.
Yeah.
It's what it shows you. Growing up in Oklahoma, I had to hit those shots all the time. And yeah. I kept on thinking, that's why Gil's playing well this week. He knows those shots.
Yep.
He's seen them. But yep. Anyway, yeah, I remember that last round. And you could hardly hit the green with a chip shot if you were in the rough. You couldn't even hit the green.
No.
So, well, anyway, great memory for you to have played in a U.S. Open and finished in the top 25. Really, really good. But, you know, one of the things – what became a sort of, after you finished your actual playing career, you still played and you competed for a long, long time, but you were a club professional, as you mentioned earlier.
Yes.
Worked for Jim Lucius at one time, Hugh Edgman at Oak Tree at one time. It was his son, yes. Chris, played for me at Edmond High School. But talk about the club pro life. My dad was a club pro 40 years. I know all about it. What can you tell people about it?
Well, I was fortunate enough growing up in the Bay Area that I had a lot of mentors that were club pros. And they all kind of took me under their wing in one shape, matter, or form. And most of them were actually very good players. And they always had the attitude that you could do both, that you could be a really good player, a really good teacher, a really good merchandiser, you know, run golf tournaments and the whole nine yards. So they always encouraged me to do that. And then, you know, I just got to a point in my life when, I had to go get a full-time job. I mean, I played in Asia and I did all that kind of stuff for a few years and it just wasn't panning out. It was time to move on. And, you know, golf is just such a, the people involved in golf, it's such a, an unbelievable environment, where, the way that you network around people. And so when I was getting ready to go get a job, you know, one of the first guys that I called was actually Jeff Walser. And I thought, you know, maybe I can get, cause he was down in the desert and he used to let me come down there and practice and play. And I knew all about Joe and Ernie and Landmark and, but they didn't have anything. He didn't have anything available. And so anyway, I ended up going to New York of all places. And I got a job in New York and I was there for a season, I guess a season. I went there from like March till October in Rochester, New York. Anyway, so I really wanted to somehow get involved with Landmark. So I reached out to Jeff again, and Jeff said, well, I think Dow Finsterwald is getting ready to leave Oak Tree Country Club. Well, I knew Dow and his dad because I was fortunate enough to win the Broadmoor Invitational twice. And I used to stay at their house when I'd go play there. And so so Jeff said, yeah, I think he's going to leave. And then that's when Jeff said, well, do you know? I said, well, who's the head pro there? And he goes, well, do you know Stan Ball? And I kind of remembered Stan's name. He goes, well, he played at OU. And I went, oh, okay, you know, yeah, I kind of remember his name. So anyway, so one thing leads to another. We're going to go back to Jim Woodward. So I find out that Jim Woodward is friends with Stan Ball. So I call Woody. And, you know, Woody, he's, you know, Mr. Helpful. Just, hey, whatever you need, blah, blah, blah. So anyway, so I ended up getting in touch with Stan, and I was fortunate to get hired, and I came to Oak Tree, and I was there kind of during the prime time, and then I was there during the crash. And when the Landmark thing kind of fell through, I had already become a PGA member, and thanks to the help from Stan Ball and Hugh Edgman and guys I worked with, Mark Fuller, small world, right? Mark Fuller's on the Houston team in 81 when we won or lost the national championship. He and I are working together, and God rest his soul. But anyway, so I've been here for 2 or 3 years, I think, and I had a short stint with my friend Mark Felder at Twin Hills. And when Mark hired me at Twin Hills, it was in the fall. And I told Mark, I said, you know, I'll come to Twin Hills and I'll help you out and whatever, but I really want to get back to California. I mean, I got my PGA membership and I'm almost 30 and I want to get home. So the guy who was the executive director of the PGA in Northern California was a friend of mine. I called him up, sent him my resume. I said, hey, if anybody's looking, I want to come out to California. So anyway, right after Thanksgiving, I get a phone call at my house. And it's this guy with this really deep voice. And he goes, hey, Cater, what are you doing? And I go, who is this? And he goes, this is Jim Lucius. And I went, oh my gosh, Jim, you know, from Southern Hills. But I knew he was at the Olympic Club. And so Jim called me and he said, hey, I understand that you want to get back out to California and you got your membership and blah, blah, blah. And I said, yeah. And he goes, boy, he goes, everybody here at Olympic Club sure knows you, because I was a junior member there. And he goes, you know, I'd really like to talk to you about coming out here and coming to work for me. And I went, Jim, I go, I tell you what, I would like nothing more to come work for you and come work and go back to the Olympic Club. And I said, but I was born and raised in San Mateo, and I know how expensive it is to live there, and I ain't going to be able to live out there on an assistant salary. And he goes, oh, well, you know, we can probably work out a deal and blah, blah, blah. And he says, well, let me send you a plane ticket and you come out here and we'll chat for a couple of days. And I went, well, I says, I'll tell you what, I'm already coming home for Christmas in December. I've already got a plane ticket. And even if you were going to hire me and I was going to start, probably not going to need to start till like March. So why don't I just see you in December? So I went out there in December and he and I chatted, and we had an interview in his office and got done with the interview. And he said something to the effect, you know, is there anything else you want to ask? You know how it goes in an interview. And I said, yeah. I go, Jim, I said, there's got to be a lot of quality people that would love to take this job, this assistant's job, and work for you. And, you know, you've got such a phenomenal background of having assistant pros move on to head pro and director of golf and all this stuff, which I would like to be a part of. But you probably got a lot of more quality people than I do. And I thought that was a really good question for him. So he looks at me and he swings his chair around in front of his desk. He pulls a drawer out and he pulls this big envelope and he hands me the envelope, and I open it up and it's all the thank you notes that I wrote him in college.
Oh, wow.
I would write him a thank you note after every year, because there were times when I was a junior and senior, even, you know, and I would call Jim and I would say, hey, you know, can I come out and play nine holes? Sure, come on out, you know. So I always wrote him a thank you note, and he had all my thank you notes. And he goes, this is why you're sitting in my office.
You know, you bring up that point. My dad was a club professional for 40 years, and every junior tournament I played in Oklahoma, my dad would tell me, Mike, you write Claude Powell a thank you note for the Perry Jr. And I would write it. I wrote thank you notes my whole junior golf career, and those paid huge dividends in relationships years later. Well, here, yeah, obviously, it did, yeah, it for you as well.
Well, I got that instilled from my parents, too, when I started playing junior golf tournaments. And then we got Coach Brogdon doing it when I moved to ORU. I told Coach, I said, you need to make sure you send these people a thank you note. And all of us on the team that played need to sign it.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, so that's, you know, and Jim was such a great mentor, and he was a good player himself. And he was very encourageable to me to keep playing and keep competing. And now that I had my PGA membership to play in the section events, and because back then, if you didn't have a PGA membership, if you weren't Class A, you couldn't play in the events. And so that's when, of the many things I learned from Jim, one of the big things I learned from him when he was at Olympic Club was he was adamant that there needed to be a golf professional on the golf course every day.
Mm-hmm.
And I went, really? And he goes, yes. And he goes, so I got to play a lot of golf. And of course I was single. I was, you know, 30 something years old. I still had a bunch of my buddies who were junior members that were now members there. They had tremendous amount of really good players at Olympic Club. So, you know, I kind of still had that little competitive edge. And then I started playing in some of the section events. And then I got into the National Club Pro a few times. And, you know, in 92, I not only played the US Open, but I played the PGA Championship too, as a club pro, and made the cut there at Belle Reve. And that was all from Jim, because he was so great to me. And he was a good teacher. He helped me a lot. And so that's kind of the path that I took.
Well, I think that the part that you, that whole story right there, reminds me of how small the world of golf is.
Yes.
How really small the world of being a PGA club professional is, because yes, everybody knows everybody. And just how you treat people matters. And if you treat people the right way coming up, you know, and you have nothing but good things to say about Jim Lucius. And I do as well. And first time I met Jim, I was 17. They had three training sessions for kids who wanted a caddy in the U.S. Open there at Southern Hills in 1977.
Mm-hmm.
And Jim ran all three of them. He was out teaching us how to rake bunkers and where to stand, yeah, and what to do. And he took me on as one of the caddies that got hired that week. So really, really enjoyed that. But great guy. Club pros, wonderful business. It's changed a little bit through the years, maybe not quite what it once was, but
no, it's totally different.
Yeah. It's not what it once, yeah, was, but no, I do love the golf business. So,
yep.
All right. You're 65. I'm on your heels. I'm there. What's on your bucket list now that you've retired? What would you like to do? One other thing in the game. What would it be?
One other thing in the game. Oh boy. You know, there's some golf courses I'd like to play.
Well, give me one.
Probably top of my list is again, small world. One of the guys that I worked with at the Olympic Club, this guy named Jim O'Neill, and Jim came from, I think he came from Kapalua. And Jim now, for the last several years, has been the head pro at the Meadow Club in California, which is a very, very nice place. But Jim and his brother have built a golf course, I think it's on the border of Colorado and Nebraska, and it's called Bally O'Neill or Bally Neal. And Jim's invited me to come up there, and it's out in the Tules. I mean, it's like an 8-hour drive from here. So that's one course I'd like to play. And I'd also like to play Crenshaw's courses at Sand Hill.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's another course I'd like to play. I've been lucky. I've played a lot. Every time the top 100 courses comes out, I mark off a lot of check marks. I've been very fortunate to have played a lot, but in the U.S., I think those are the two that I probably would like to go play again.
Well, then if I talk to you a year from now, let's hope you've done that. But Jim, thanks for spending an hour with me. This has been great. Great catching up, but also the great history that you talked about and the things you brought to the forefront that I think are great memories for you, but certainly good college golf history. So thank you so
Mike.
Much.
Thank you.
All right. Well, keep on playing. Don't stop that. And we'll catch up with you sometime again soon. Thanks,
okay.
Jim.
Best of luck, Mike.
All right. Thanks.